This week on Making Contact,
they would say, I am an elite woman, a white woman in black skin. Can you imagine?
I'm not an anti-Israeli Jew. I actually have deep, passionate love for Israel, and that is exactly the reason why I'm so engaged.
Women worldwide are gaining influence as leaders, struggling for peace, justice, the environment, and civil society. On this program, we profile three women. Wangari Maathai founded the Green Belt Movement in Kenya. Devorah Browse founded Bustan LaShalom, a peace and justice organization in Israel-Palestine. Lydia Alpizar created Elige, a youth organization in Mexico focusing on violence against women. I'm Sandina Robbins, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. This program is a collaboration with the Women Rising Radio Project. Wangari Maathai founded the Green Belt Movement in Kenya with the simple act of a few women planting trees. Now the movement has spread throughout Africa, mobilizing communities for self-determination, equity, improved livelihood, and environmental conservation. This planting of native fruit-bearing trees is creating a greener, cleaner Africa. In January 2003, Wangari Maathai won a seat in Kenya's parliament.
When I was a very young child, I did the work that young girls do, like help mother collect firewood. But one day I was going to collect firewood, and my mother told me not to collect any firewood from the fig tree. And naturally I asked her, why? And she told me, this is a tree of God. This is where we offer sacrifices. So you never cut a fig tree. I let alone came to understand that fig trees play a major role in the water system, and that because they are never cut, they become enormous trees. Therefore, their roots are very deep. They must go all the way into the subterranean, and they must somehow break the rocks and allow water to come up, the underground water to come up, so that almost everywhere in our country where one found a fig tree, very close to that, you would find a spring. And indeed, very close to where we lived, near that fig tree, there was a very beautiful spring from which I used to fetch water. But some 10 years later, this fig tree was cut down to make way for coffee and tea plantations. And true to nature, the spring dried up. It helped me understand what would eventually happen to our country if more cutting down of trees would continue. But I also had another inspiration when I attended a seminar. And at this seminar, the presenter was talking about diseases associated with malnutrition in the central part of the country. And this is part of the country that is supposed to be very affluent. So I was shocked to learn that we had opened it up to commercial agriculture of cash crops. We had cleared bushes, we had cut down the trees. And so women did not have enough firewood to maintain the traditional cooking methods and the traditional food crops. As the communities shifted from farming food crops for household consumption to producing cash crops, they had become a society dependent on cash, and they depended on buying food from shops. And most of this food was processed food. And although they were supposed to be very progressive, quite clearly, they were malnourishing themselves, especially their children. And the idea of planting trees with these women came to me. And it was just a lucky idea because the tree became a wonderful symbol of so many other things, not just overcoming malnutrition in the central part of the country. And when you plant a tree, it grows. And it's almost like you get a relationship. You develop a relationship with the tree. It gives you fruit if it is a fruit tree. It gives you firewood. You can build your houses with it. So the tree is a wonderful symbol of hope, of the power we have in our hands to change our lives for the better. We started about 25 years ago, and we started with a very small tree nursery in my backyard. And today we have over 100,000 women involved. About 20 million trees have been planted. But perhaps the most important accomplishment, I would say, is the raising of awareness in the country and within the region of Africa that they cannot live in this region if their environment is destroyed. We have raised that issue from a non-issue in the 70s to a political high on the agenda issue. And decision makers now cannot afford to appear like they ignore the environment. It was a real revolution. And that is really the secret of the Green Belt Movement, is mobilizing communities to do little activities, but repeated by thousands of people at the same time. To mobilize people, you have to organize them, you have to educate them, you have to train them. And that, as I say, for those in power, is not allowed. And so they would say, I am an elite woman, a white woman in black skin, trained and educated in America, very Western oriented. Therefore, I'm going to pollute the good African rural woman. Can you imagine? When you get to the political level and you begin challenging those in power, it becomes very dangerous because they will try to stop, and they have tried to stop me, partly by arresting me, putting me in jail, charging me with crimes, which is mainly for intimidation. What they really hope is that I will feel sufficiently intimidated and afraid, and I drop the whole thing, and I go home and I say, forget it. The other reason why they do that is a lot of those women I work with would be afraid, because they would say, well, if they can take her and lock her up overnight in a police cell, guess what they'll do to me? And this is supposed to intimidate people. And that's why you need a critical mass, because you need enough people to encourage each other so that with this kind of government action, they are not intimidated. We have a critical mass in Kenya. Now we can say with confidence that in Kenya we have a critical mass, and we know we are right. And that's what gives us the power to continue, and to continue telling our leaders that they are doing the wrong things. Perhaps because we are women, we have the capacity to say so, because we are not doing so because we want to acquire this wealth ourselves. We do not want really to possess it. We just want it to be there for everybody. We are not against our government. We love our government. We love our leaders. But we love our country more.
Devorah Brous immigrated to Israel from the United States in 1993. There she founded Bustan LaShalom, or Peace Grove, an organization devoted to achieving economic parity, human rights, and basic human services for marginalized communities in Israel, focusing on its 70,000 Bedouin citizens. Bustan LaShalom also works to foster understanding between Israelis and Palestinians.
When I first came over to Israel, I was interested in this idea of peace, but most of the people that I was meeting were telling me they had never met a Palestinian, and I realized that there was a big distinction, a big separation between the populations, that Jews and Arabs don't really interact or integrate very much. I found out about some dialogue work that was going on in the field and became involved with that, with dialogue projects. Well, the dialogue projects were really, really exciting, and there were a lot of healers and a lot of artists that were involved and drawn to this work. A lot of women activists were really drawn because we're able to get some deep communication going, able to really touch on our deepest pockets of pain and express what it is that we're feeling, what it is that we're fearing, what it is that we're hoping. We started to do projects in Gaza with tree plantings, and we started to go on walks. We walked from Israel's Dead Sea to the Red Sea. We crossed the border at Aqaba and planted trees in Jordan. And the whole idea of these kind of projects was to say, let's see each other as human beings and not as us and them. So we began to recognize that this combination of having dialogue and then getting involved with action together was a powerful link. That's where Bustan comes in to the picture. We went into look at the conditions in different villages to try to understand that perhaps some of the hatred that is being generated between our peoples is coming from an unequal distribution of resources. So we would go inside the villages that were unrecognized by the Israeli government. And the first one that we were in was called Derajat Village. And we spent a year engaging intensely with people from the village, the indigenous Bedouin. So Bustan was involved with bringing large groups of people together to have festivals, which would allow us to plant trees together and bring large amounts of people who had never heard of unrecognized villages actually inside the village and have the chance to go on tours of the village and learn from the Bedouin people what it means to be living in a village when you're not on the map, when you're not actually recognized by your own government and you've professed loyalty to that government. What does that mean? How does that feel? A lot of the work of Bustan is engaging on the level of human rights and land rights, and we're examining the land tenure issues. We're looking at these unrecognized villages and trying to examine what Israel expects the people from these villages to do. This land is considered state land by Israel. Israel wants to have that land for its own purposes for development and use. So we began looking at the infrastructural discrimination. We began to examine what's happening inside the village when there are 4,000 villagers that don't have access to medical care, don't have water. So we became engaged with the Jahalin Bedouin who are living near the Maale Adumim settlement in East Jerusalem, Area C. These are Bedouin who were displaced from their homes in Tel Arad in the 1950s. They were moved to the West Bank, where they were living as nomads, and they had goat-haired tents, and they were raising livestock and growing produce, living very close to the land. And in the 1990s, they were displaced forcibly from their tents. Their possessions were destroyed, and they were moved to 500 meters away from a municipal garbage dump site of Jerusalem, where they're living today. Some of them are living in shipping containers. Some of them are living in corrugated tin shacks. And it's very despairing to see the difference between the way they're living without water and electricity in these shacks and the way that the Jewish settlers are living inside Maale Adumim. It's very disturbing to look at this difference. In working with the villagers, we began to understand that their foremost objective is to provide schooling for their children. So Bustan was working with Rabbis for Human Rights and Ibrahim Abul Hawa and the Jahalin villagers. And the idea was to bring together a group of activists and group of artists and musicians and to help the Jahalin help themselves by establishing a school. Today there are 100 children learning in two separate trailers. One is for girls and one is for boys. This kind of project was really grounding and really inspiring for our next effort, which is in a village called Wadi Na'am. It's a Bedouin village inside Israel that's also unrecognized by the Israeli government. The 4,000 villagers of Wadi Na'am are living next to Ramat Hovav, the incinerator, Israel's toxic waste dump. And the children are sick, and they have skin cancer. And the animals of this village are sick, and they're also living next to an electric plant and underneath electric pylons that supply electricity to the Jewish neighborhoods throughout the northern Negev. They have no electricity themselves. So we're working with the village community heads to have a six-day event, which would involve creating a medical clinic using sustainable development techniques, including straw bale construction and mud brick. And the clinic will be solar powered.
For her advocacy work, Devorah Brous and Bustan LaShalom have been criticized as being against the State of Israel.
I remember meeting a woman. She started spewing at me that it's Jews like you, it's the leftist Jews like you, that make Israel have a bad name. And you're an anti-Semite, and you're an anti-loyalist, and you're an anti-Jew-Jew, and all of this hateful words. I think it's really painful to be marginalized. It's really easy for people to stick you in a category and try to delegitimize you because of your opinions. But the fact is that I'm not anti-Jewish, and I'm not an anti-Semite, and I'm not an anti-Israeli Jew. I actually have deep, passionate love for Israel, and that is exactly the reason why I'm so engaged, why I'm giving my life to work for understanding between Jews and Palestinians. Bustan is going inside hospitals in Jerusalem and meeting with survivors of the terror, hearing their stories, standing in solidarity with them, sharing their pain, often sitting in silence, often sharing prayer, trying to learn more about the situation and its repercussions, and trying to get to a place where it becomes very clear for anybody who's involved with Bustan that there is no simple black and white in this conflict. Both sides are suffering, and that the only way to eradicate the terror that leaves me terrified in my own streets is to work towards ending this occupation.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you want more information about the subject of this week's program, please give us a call. It's toll-free, 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for CD or tape orders. That's 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website, radioproject.org. That's radioproject.org. Lydia Alpizar was born in Costa Rica. She became an activist for women's rights as a teenager and moved to Mexico to join its vital women's movement. There, Lydia founded Elige, which means choose, a youth advocacy group focusing on reproductive and sexual rights and violence against women.
My childhood and adolescence was pretty much marked by domestic violence, not sexual, but physical violence. And I think there was a sense inside me that always told me this was not fair, this was not just, that I was a human being with dignity and no one should face these kinds of things. And when I had the chance to do My first approach to social issues when I was very young, like around 17 years old, I wanted to get involved in doing a work that could make a difference and that I could channel the anger I felt around injustice and impunity issues.
I started to be active in a non-governmental organization, and as the work, you know, developed and time went by, gender issues started to pump up because most of the people participating in the organization were women, but usually the decisions were made by the men. So that moved me to start doing work on gender issues with young women, for example, for issues related to violence against young women, getting kicked out of the school because they were getting pregnant or because they were single mothers.
Lydia and her group Elige have joined a coalition of Mexican human rights groups to demand justice for hundreds of murdered women in Ciudad Juarez on the U.S.-Mexico border.
The issue of Ciudad Juarez started to come into the press, into the media, around 1996. It was kind of a really scary case because there were all these bodies of women appearing in the desert, most of them really young, all of them with signs of sexual violence and torture, you know, like mutilation, and, you know, more bodies almost every month.
Ciudad Juarez is, it's kind of a pilot city for free trade in Mexico, you know. It's a very interesting place. Lots of sweatshops, you know, maquila factories, transnational corporations, you know, have their factories there. That has meant that the people who are getting employed by those factories are mostly women. And that means that the opportunities for women employment are usually a little bit better than for men. Ciudad Juarez is a very violent city in itself, you know. The cartel of Juarez, which is a drug dealing cartel, it's located there. So there is a lot of narcotraffic related violence too. Ciudad Juarez is the city that provides the largest income to the whole state, but it's a city that doesn't have a proper water system, you know? It rains and the whole city flows. So it's a very good example of how globalization and free trade are being impacting the local communities where so much wealth is being taken from. And the conditions of women in the maquiladoras are really bad. So I think there is a very big issue about globalization and free trade and what is it meaning in terms of violence against women. And one of the challenges we have as a campaign is to draw more clearly the links between the maquilas, the free trade agreement, and this issue. But we think that it's definitely connected. We have a kind of a legal strategy. There are some lawyers that are part of the campaign that have been going to Juarez and doing field work and have been serving as supporting lawyers in the case and some of the specific cases with the families of these murdered women. And what we are trying to do is to choose from all of those cases one that shows all the negligence, sexism, and lack of effective response on the side of the authorities to stop the killings and bring justice to these women. And so we want to choose one paradigmatic case that will be presented to the Inter-American Human Rights Commission. And we think that bringing the case to the Inter-American Commission could be a very powerful tool to empower the struggle that we're facing in Mexico to get the authorities to take this issue in a really serious way and do effective work around it. We've been doing work with the journalists and with media so that they can change the way they've been covering the issue. Media have lost somehow the sense that these are women who are being killed, these are human beings with their own stories, and that these women have the right to have justice, you know, and no women should be living in a place where, you know, women are
worth almost nothing, and no, someone can just come and kill you like that, and nothing really happens. The other strategy is putting political pressure to different authorities at the local level in Juarez, at the state level in Chihuahua, and at the federal level. And also trying to build solidarity with groups of women from all parts of the world, too, because we think until there is not a strong political pressures from the outside, probably the Mexican government won't take this issue seriously, because that's basically the situation we have seen since 1993. Mujer, mujer, sin distingo social, sin edad ni color, de piel. I would say I mostly have a lot of faith in women, in our capacity to overcome the difficulties we face in our lives, in our capacity to move on every day. That's one of the most empowering things of working with the women's movement. Something that gives me lots of strength and vision is to feel that I am part of all these women that through history have struggled to change women's status. There have been very important gainings in the last decades for women, but those are very much threatened by the current situation of the world, where different kinds of fundamentalism are kind of putting us as women in a very bad position. So I think we have to continue to work together to hold on to what we have gained, but also to continue to move forward. And I think that it's very important that we all feel that we are part of this process and of women working together. Vida crea, fuerza.
That's it for this Women's Desk edition of Making Contact, a look at three courageous women leaders. These profiles were co-produced by Lynn Feinerman and Lisa Rudman, based on material from Lynn Feinerman's Women Rising radio series, a project of Crown Safira Productions. If you want more information about these women, or if you'd like to order a CD of this program, our toll-free number is 800-529-5736. You can also visit our website at radioproject.org. That's radioproject.org. Be sure to listen to other Women's Desk programs on our website. Special thanks this week to Kimberly Ross and Sarissa Tanner for production assistance. Music from Umu Sangare, from Habre Ra Hativit, Shir Lo Shalom, and from Claro Oscuro, the song Mujer. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Peggy Law is our founding director, managing producer Philip Babich, associate producer Amy Pomerlow, office manager Rosalind Fay, associate manager Susanna Hines, senior advisor Norman Solomon, national producer David Barsamian, and I'm your host, Sandina Robbins. Making Contact is an independent production. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you have suggestions for future programs, we'd like to hear from you. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Until next time.